Welcome to the Science Update Podcast. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is the podcast for July 15th, 2011.
The Science Update Podcast is produced by AAAS, advancing science, serving society.
Now we can not only say whether that person is a male or female, but we can actually make a fairly accurate estimate of the age of that person.
When you're looking at a smiling face, the same brain areas are showing activity as when you're eating chocolate or listening to a good piece of music.
The pigeons in the cities are quite smart and they know very well who can feed them and who is hostile toward them, and they can learn this very quickly.
This week, why pigeons are paying attention to our faces and the genetics of gazing at happy faces. Also, there's a new test that can determine your age from your DNA and the hormone behind stress eating. But first, Suzanne Bard tackles a hot question.
This one's from Laura, a listener from Tacoma Park, Maryland. She wants to know what causes the uncomfortable flushing of hot flashes. We asked Dr. Robert Friedman of the Wayne State University School of Medicine and also a founding member of the North American Menopause Society. He says the body regulates temperature like a thermostat, maintaining a neutral zone in which a person doesn't feel too hot or cold. But in women undergoing menopause, this neutral zone is very narrow. So a small increase in temperature triggers the body's cooling mechanisms.
Your blood vessels dilate rapidly to increase blood flow, mainly in the arms and legs and hands and feet and forehead, to dissipate heat, thereby lowering your core body temperature. It acts like a giant radiator.
Friedman says the drop in estrogen levels during menopause is necessary for hot flashes to occur, but doesn't completely explain what causes them. And if you have a science question, give us a call at 1-800-WHY-IS-IT. If we use your question, we'll send you a Science Update mug.
Thanks, Suzanne. Stress often prompts people to reach for tasty, high-fat comfort foods like ice cream or chocolate. Now researchers are starting to unravel the reasons why. Jeffrey Zygmunt is an endocrinologist and neuroscientist at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. He and his colleagues studied the role played by the hormone ghrelin, which regulates hunger and eating behavior. They found that ordinary mice put under stress sought out fatty, pleasurable food. But mice engineered not to respond to ghrelin chose their food differently.
And we found that in those mice, they were not able to go to the diet which is thought to be more pleasurable.
Zygmunt and colleagues found that ghrelin acts in a part of the brain involved in addiction and reward, providing a potential pathway for understanding why eating might help relieve stress. Next, thanks to shows like CSI, everyone knows that DNA samples can sometimes help nab a crook. But current forensic tests only reveal part of the story. A new test adds another tool to the CSI's arsenal. Our guest correspondent Karina Wu has that story.
DNA samples from a crime scene can only tell investigators so much, whether the person is male or female, for example, or if the samples match DNA profiles already on file. But now, scientists have found a way to tell a person's age from their DNA. Molecular geneticist Sven Bocklund, now at the company BioLine, worked on the research while at UCLA.
Now we can not only say whether that person is a male or female, but we can actually make a fairly accurate estimate of the age of that person.
He and his colleagues analyzed small chemical changes in DNA that happen over time. Bocklund says humans have about 3 billion spots where these chemical changes can occur.
Of these 3 billion, we had to measure just 2 to make this accurate prediction of someone's age. So that was way, way, way more precise than I ever expected.
With this method, they can pinpoint a person's age to within 5 years, making it a potential tool for forensics or personalized medicine.
The idea would be that you could go to your doctor and get your bio-age measured, and that bio-age is really used as a sort of tool to decide what kind of care you need.
The study was done with saliva samples, but Bocklund says the method should also work with other tissues, such as hair and blood.
Thanks, Karina. If you're one of those people who feed pigeons in the park, you may be surprised to learn that the pigeons are also watching you. This according to animal behaviorist Davila Beauvais of the University of Nanterre in France. Her research suggests that the scrappy birds can tell humans apart. She and her colleagues had 2 people in different colored lab coats feed pigeons in a Paris park. Both fed the pigeons the same amount of food, but one let the birds eat in peace while the other chased them off. Within a few days, the pigeons learned to avoid the hostile person and continued to do so even after the feeders traded lab coats.
So they were really discriminating the people and not only their clothes. What was surprising for us was not that the pigeons were able to discriminate between the people. We saw that they would do it, but we didn't know that they would do it so quickly. So it was only 3 to 4 days with one training session of 30 minutes per day.
Beauvais speculates that this ability may be due to the pigeons' long association with us, since being able to distinguish a dangerous human from a friendly one could help them survive. She says the research could make people think twice about the pigeons they see around them.
The pigeons in the cities are quite smart, and they know very well who can feed them and who is hostile toward them, and they can learn this very quickly.
But she adds that some other animals, like crows, mockingbirds, monkeys, and dogs, also seem to share the ability to discriminate between human faces. Finally today, Suzanne says the time we humans spend gazing at people's faces may be influenced by our genes.
For most people, looking at happy faces activates pleasure centers in the brain.
When you're looking at a smiling face, the same brain areas are showing activity as when you're eating chocolate or listening to a good piece of music.
That's University of Reading neuroscientist Bhishma Chakrabarty. Now, he and Cambridge psychologist Simon Baron-Cohen have shown that the amount of time people spend gazing at happy faces is influenced by variations in a gene called CNR1. The gene codes for cannabinoid receptors in the brain, which are involved in our experience of pleasure.
This whole endocannabinoid system works together with the dopamine system in the brain, and dopamine is this neurotransmitter involved in coding for reward.
The researchers had volunteers watch videos of both happy and disgusted faces and measured how long they spent gazing at mouths and eyes. They also analyzed each volunteer's DNA to see which variants of the CNR1 gene they carried.
And we found that the length of time people were gazing at a happy face was a function of the cannabinoid receptor gene variation.
In contrast, they didn't find a relationship between the gene and the amount of time volunteers spent looking at the disgusted faces.
This is the first work to show that genetic differences might underlie differences in gaze patterns.
Chakrabarty says the findings could have implications for autism research because people with autism gaze at faces differently than the general population. He speculates that if autistic children don't get pleasure from looking at happy faces, that may affect how they socialize with others as they mature.
One could speculate that if you are a child and you are not having an equivalent reward response to looking at your caregiver's happy face, then presumably you would not socialize to that extent. And the degree to which you will socialize is essentially dependent on all the positive feedback that you're getting when you're growing up as a child. And if the happy face is not a rewarding object to you, then you can imagine that over a period of time, especially early on in development, this can lead to patterns of atypical social behavior and hence can lead to manifestation of more autistic symptoms. And at this point, I emphasize that this is a very speculative, but this is what we are thinking.
He stresses that more work is needed to determine if the CNR1 gene variants of autistic people are different from those of the general population.
Thanks, Suzanne. Well, that's our show for this week. Next week, we'll have a whole new set of thought-provoking science stories for you. Until then, tune into the Science Update Podcast Daily Edition every day, Monday through Friday. You can find it on our website, scienceupdate.com, or at iTunes. You can also check out Science Update's fan page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.